But it's a dramatic change, so let's take just a moment to look at what we've seen previously in chapter 2. Gomer, the wife of Hosea, has played the harlot or the whore, and much of that story has already been told in chapter 2. For instance, in verse 7, she shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And then it sums up the situation. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. The woman, in particular Gomer, had believed that the good things were coming from Baal rather than from the Lord. So verse 9, therefore I will take her back, my grain in its time and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, all the things that were beneficial to one, and they had begun to think in terms of that comes from Baal. I will uncover her lewdness, verse 10, in the sight of her lovers. I think it's Ezekiel. Maybe I shouldn't bring it up without knowing, but one of the prophets actually uses this phrase, uncover her lewdness, to describe the captivity itself, that that would be Judah, if it's Ezekiel, rather than Israel, as in this case. But it's a phrase that other prophets use. I'll uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. Verse 11, I will put an end to all her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, etc. I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees. She didn't recognize where the good things came from, and so they'll be taken away as punishment. Verse 12, and I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. But then there is a dramatic change. Verse 14, therefore behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to me. Allure could be understood in terms of seducing or enticing, but at the end of the verse we have the commentary on that, to speak tenderly to her. So it's a betrayal of grace that is coming. The Lord will, in other words, woo his estranged wife away from her lovers with the language of courtship, the tender words. Bring her into the wilderness. That may seem strange to us, but it seems to picture a happier time in the marriage. We'll go back to the beginning days. That doesn't mean much sense to us moderns, except that we know the story of Israel being brought out of Egypt into the wilderness. Wilderness may bother us, but that was the honeymoon period and happier time, a time when God cared for all of Israel's needs. Well, again, the wilderness had been the Sinai, the deliverance from Egypt. Okay, I've thrown this in here. I realize after I went back over my notes that some of them are a little bit out of order, so hopefully I can explain them. You can listen to me and maybe make sense of things. This is something I ran across last week and decided to to share with you at this point before I forgot it. One of the well-known books on the prophets in past decades has been Kyle Yates' Preaching from the Prophets. And I ran across this quote the other day, forgotten where, but I went back to him. The book is as old as I am, but he still has a lot of good things in it. Here's his quote. Hosea takes his place among the greatest lovers of all the ages. His love was so strong that the vilest behavior could not dull it. Gomer broke his heart, but she made it possible for him to give to the world a picture of the heart of the divine lover. Well, that's his opinion, that he's the greatest lover of all times, but he's right in saying that Hosea, of course, is the picture of God's love for us. Okay, God begins to turn the page. Verse 15, and there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. There's a contrast here that's as stark, as different as most anything we could come up with. The Valley of Achor, I'm going to make that into a door of hope. I think maybe the next slide makes that a little clearer. Remember in Judges chapter 7, Achan, though he was instructed, commanded not to take any of the precious things from the city of Jericho when the walls were taken down, nevertheless did. And this is one of the harshest punishments I can think of in Scripture. Not only Achan, but his wife and his family. Not just the family, but his animals. Not just the animals, but his possessions as well. Think of all those being put in one place, stacked on one another, as it were, killed and then burned, and then a pile of stones stacked on top. God was doing this with several exclamation points, I think. Well, Achor is that place where Achan and all of his possessions were put to death. So that's one extreme, and then contrasted with that here is the door of hope. Okay, the present bondage, and sometimes I have to look back again to see what the comparisons are. The previous bondage was from Egypt into the wilderness. This bondage is to the worship of Baal. The Lord would bring Israel into a new wilderness of spiritual discipline, guidance, blessing, and would speak there to Israel a message of love. Well, a great dramatic difference between the Valley of Trouble and the door of hope. Verse 16, and in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. In whatever day that is that the Lord lures Israel back as his wife, then this will be the case. There's a little bit of a play on words here. The I is the possessive. So Ish, husband, Ishi is my husband. It's a little harder with Baal. Baal is not really equivalent to husband. It's more like master. So the difference, and I need to keep that in mind, is my husband with a husband's love as opposed to Baal, my master. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. Israel will devote herself exclusively to the Lord and not to Baal. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beast of the field and the birds of the heavens and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and will make you lie down in safety. There are a couple of places, I think, in this section of Hosea where we have wording that reminds us of the early chapters of Genesis, words that deal with the creation itself. This seems to be one of those, a promise that not only with humankind, but the beast of the field, the birds of the heaven, the creeping things of the ground. A few verses down, we're going to encounter even the fish of the sea. Well, make you lie down in safety is the ultimate blessing. I don't know whether you think about this very much or not. We live in a world that's hard for me to understand. I guess I live in a part of town that is not affected directly by so much of this, but I hear gunshots in my neighborhood as well at times. But the cycle of the news is a murder here, a couple of murders there, and this is something that I haven't experienced in my earlier days. And it troubles me. I'm sure it troubles you as well. Three betroths in these couple of verses. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in judgment, in steadfast love and in mercy. Three times, I think that's obviously an emphasis. Israel will no longer be a harlot or a prostitute. The Lord will provide a dowry. He provides, not the bride, righteousness, justice, steadfast love, and mercy. And again, let's remind one another, steadfast love and mercy are two different things saying almost the same thing, and that's a key message to Hosea. The third betroth, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Well, the foundation of God's throne is righteousness and justice, Psalm 89 and Psalm 97. Okay, we're doing a turnaround, as I've already suggested, beginning at verse 14, but in particular, 20, 21, and 2 and 3, if I look back at chapter 1, and particularly the names given there, no mercy, not my people, and so forth. If I look back at, and that's basically what I have in verse 4, 6, and 9, all of that is reversed. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. That's when the marriage of God and Israel is again consummated, and all the hardships before are reversed. And the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, the oil. They shall answer Jezreel. Remember, Jezreel suggested God sows, but we earlier found an understanding of it that suggests that God scatters. The motion of sowing for someone sowing seed in biblical times would be by hand, and one who does it well would sow. One who didn't would basically be scattered. But earlier, the reference is obviously to scattering. Punishment was suggested, but here again, we're back to the good side of that term. God sows, and I will sow her for myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy, and I will say to not my people, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. Remember the words, I don't know how many translations actually translate lo ruhama, not, no mercy, and lo ami, not my people. The ESV translates that for us in the first chapter, and that's good for us to know exactly what that says. And so in verse 23, we're looking back to that. This is a part of the change. I'll sow her in a good sense. I'll have mercy on the one who did not have mercy, and the people who were not my people are now my people. One of the difficult things in Hosea, I think, is understanding those things that obviously look ahead well into the future, the last days and so forth. And I can't answer all those questions for you. I do know there's a problem when I'm reading an interpreter who suggests all of that takes place during the thousand-year reign. I don't believe that. I don't believe that you do either. We do have this much help, though, and I think this is an appropriate time to say it. The Apostle Paul quotes the last part of 2:23, and then back in chapter 1, verse 10, he quotes it in Romans 9, 25 and 26. And when I go there and look at that, I think the Apostle Paul, obviously in that situation, is speaking to the present dispensation under Jesus Christ. So, difficult to make application for those, but I at least know what the Apostle Paul says there. Actually, the Apostle Peter does much the same thing in 1 Peter 2:10. Okay. Reconciliation, I think in a sense it's talked about in this last part of chapter 1, but expressed more directly here in a short chapter, five verses in chapter 3. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. Apparently, people who've studied these pagan religions, and in particular the worship of Baal, think they know most things, but not many people seem to know what cakes of raisins are. It's obviously connected with pagan worship in some way, and I think surely it's a gift, a blessing that they received at the worship of Baal. In a sense, we're already doing this in the verses that we've been looking at in the last part of chapter 2, but here in a little more formal way, God says to Hosea, go again, take a woman who is loved by another man, love her again. Some people don't think this is Gomer. I think for sure it's Gomer. If it's not Gomer, then I think the analogy of Gomer with Israel breaks down completely. Clearly, I think Hosea is told, go take your wayward wife And by taking her back, others will know that the Lord still loves Israel. Spiritually, his unfaithful wife. I think our first session I talked about action sermons that this prophet and that prophet worked out in their actions at God's direction. This is another action sermon. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethek of barley. I think that's a homer and a half of barley. I notice interpreters argue about this as well. Did he buy her back at a slave auction? Some say yes and some say no. If not, then she's in a situation where Hosea has to put out some money just to get her back. So the specifics, I think, I don't need to worry about, but they're a little different. Normally, 30 shekels of silver would be the price of a common slave. Exodus 21. This is half that, but then there's barley thrown in. If I had lived in that time and I was careful about what I spent on groceries, I'd be buying barley rather than wheat. It was cheaper, not as nutritious as I understand it, although we still eat barley in things today. And notice in Numbers 5 that barley is the offering that one makes when they were accused of adultery. Well, there are details there that I'm not absolutely sure about. I think we could understand this from the side that it's not a tremendous amount of money that Hosea has to put out to bring Gomer back. But on the other hand, if it is the cheap price, that simply shows the desperate condition into which Gomer had fallen, and he was willing to pay the price. There is a catch, though, verse 3, and I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man, so will I also be to you. So she would not be allowed conjugal relations for many days with anyone, including Hosea. Why would this be so? To make sure that the trial period, make sure that she's faithful to him, maybe a period to see whether or not she is bearing a child from another one. But again, this is a picture of God's love for Israel and being willing, in spite of the past, to take her back. The fact that she is to dwell for many days also is a picture of Israel. And this, again, takes us to things in the future that are difficult to deal with. Verse 4, for the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Okay, one could wonder, does this picture the beginning of the Assyrian captivity? And that wouldn't be far away, 20 years, maybe as much as 30 years. But other terms like the latter days seem to indicate that's well beyond not only Israel's captivity, but Judah's captivity as well. And again, we can talk more later about latter days. And the Apostle Paul, as I mentioned, seems to put these things into the Christian age. What this verse says, by the way, this will be a time when Israel basically is in limbo, won't really have a secure king or prince, so the political side of things for the nation, without sacrifice or pillar, okay? The pillar in particular is again, a part of Baal worship. So whether I think about pleasing worship to God or whether I think of the unlawful worship of God, worship of Baal and other gods, Israel is going to be out without all of those, it seems to say. She neither has God with her for that period of time, nor does she have Baal. I'm not exactly sure. Household gods obviously go back all the way to the patriarchs. So they've been with God's people, or they've had to deal with them back in Abraham's time. But there were still household gods around. The pillar we've talked about, usually the sign of the female Baal. Ephod, the priests of Israel, had a garment. I think it's one of the outer garments that's an ephod, and many say that in Baal worship and other things was used in ways that was not pleasing to God either. So everything is covered here. She'll be without king, she'll be without religion. Okay, some more commentary that I've basically gone over. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. But there's a twist here, and again, it's difficult for me to know in detail what's suggested, but obviously this is not to say that Israel will again one day have her king. Their king will be David. And remember, Israel is a northern kingdom, not the southern kingdom, not David's kingdom. So this is a prophecy of the future. They'll not go back to their kings, but ultimately to David. In other words, God is spelling out here, even through Hosea, that ultimately God will honor the covenant with David, not Jeroboam or not one of the other kings of the Israelites. And again, this brings us in some way to the latter days, as in Isaiah 2, verse 2. Okay, just a little note as we go into chapter 4. This is speaking broadly, but chapters 4 through 10 tell us how God will forgive the sins of his people. And then immediately in verse 4, we'll have an indictment brought against Israel. So there are several things ahead. But one of the things about this section I think is true. The Lord wanted to forgive the sins of his people and restore fellowship, but they're not ready. So we'll be in a period in these chapters where basically the people would not repent. They wouldn't admit that they had sinned. So there are several chapters basically of a court case against Israel. God conducts a trial and brings them to the bar of, of justice. Another thing I ran across, the first item on this slide, I've forgotten where this is from, but Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, president about 220 years ago, is supposed to have said this: "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." That kind of pictures, I think, the feeling that Hosea had as well. He knew his people were deep in sin, and he could not but tremble when he thought about how they stood before God. Okay, the controversy, which basically is an indictment in a courtroom. "Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There's no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land." It's not a personal case. It's against all the inhabitants of the land. What's the covenant? Well, it was the one made at Mount Sinai, and the people at Mount Sinai said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." But they have broken that promise, and this is played out here in these chapters ahead of us. God's laws for sure, but the examples that we'll see seem to come here from the Ten Commandments. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. This last phrase really stood out for me in the cycle of news. It seems like one bloodshed overlaps on another, and we don't have something in between. Well, these are Hosea's words in that way as well. When the people reject God's covenant, they're not only rebelling against God, but always they are beginning to sin against one another, to abuse one another. If we love the Lord, we will love our neighbor, and if not, we probably do not love our neighbor either. No mercy in the land, no love for one's neighbor, no compassion for the poor and needy. People are false-hearted toward God and hard-hearted toward one another. Therefore, the land mourns. This seems strange, but we'll need to look at, for instance, Leviticus 26. There God says he would bless the land if the people obeyed him, but he would punish the land if the people disobeyed. So it's expressed here, therefore the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the fields and the birds of the heavens and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Another way of looking at this, I think, is God's punishment upon the people in this time. Well, when charges are brought, most of us will deny, or maybe we'll accuse others. I'm not guilty, but so-and-so is guilty. Hosea seems to say to the priest, don't blame the people. They're just following your example. Verse 4, yet let no one contend, and let none accuse, for with you is my contention, O priest. You may understand better than I do, but one of the things I might overlook at times, I think of the priest as performing sacrifice and the ceremonial things of that kind, but I may forget that if I go back to Leviticus and other places, I'll find out that a responsibility of the priest is to teach the law. So particularly in this context, I need to remember that the priest is a teacher. And this court case, among other things, names the priest as sinning and failing to teach and to lead the people. We're about 200 years long in the northern kingdom being separate from the southern kingdom. So this happened a good while before. We may have read one example of this. Jeroboam the first king of the northern kingdom, decided, you know, if I don't change some things, my people will go back to Judah. They'll go back to Jerusalem to worship and so forth. They do that very long, and I won't have a kingdom. I'll lose it all. And so he established worship in Bethel, which is almost on the border with Judah, and in Dan, far to the north. He himself seems to have had his primary connection with Bethel. But one of the things he did, of course, besides putting up two golden calves, one in Bethel and one in Dan, was he changed other times. He changed the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, for instance. He appointed priests from not the tribe of Levi, as was proper and lawful, but he chose them from other tribes. But more than that, theoretically, someone who was from the wrong tribe could still be a good teacher and good priest. But these counterfeit priests seemingly themselves neither know God nor his law. You shall stumble by day. The prophet also shall stumble with you by night, and I will destroy your mother. Mother, on the basis of chapter 2, 4, and 5, I think we'd understand Israel. I'll destroy the kingdom, your mother. Well, if I don't know the law, or I don't care for the law, if I don't care for the things that are my responsibility as a priest, then yes, I'll stumble, even in daytime, certainly at night. And the prophet is right there along with me. I think I could understand this is a false prophet, all right, but nevertheless, hand in hand, they are leaders of the people, but not righteous leaders. There are several ways of saying this. This is one I noticed recently, so I chose it. You've heard something like this, though: as goes spiritual leadership, so goes the church. As goes the church, so goes morality. And as goes morality, so goes the nation. God's people, I fear today, are rather small in number compared to what is needed to influence the nation. But one of the general lessons of Hosea, I think, certainly would be in terms like this. This is a terrible situation the kingdom is in. This verse, probably the best known verse in all of Hosea. If you remember hearing a sermon preached from Hosea, chances are good it was on this verse, or brought this verse in. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you've rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. And since you've forgotten the law of your God, I will forget your children. Well, again, priests were responsible for teaching, and they have failed because the people don't have knowledge. And the implication is the priests didn't have knowledge either. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me, I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sin of my people. They are greedy for their iniquity. I'm not sure about this, but it was interesting enough to me to suggest you think about it. I'm using the English Standard Version. The English Standard Version has a footnote with sin in this passage. It could, in the context of the translators say, refer to the sin offering. The sin offering was a precious, a most holy offering. The people did not get to share in eating that offering. Only the priest could eat from it. There almost seems like a play on words here, maybe suggesting that priests literally fed on the sin offerings as they would lawfully do, but maybe the implication is they also fed on, followed the people's example in sinning. In fact, one of the reasons I think the translators bring that up, this phrase, they are greedy for their iniquity, literally says they lift their soul to their iniquity, which suggests maybe that they reveled in their sins. They didn't just sin, they reveled in it. In language that I might use, I would wonder, does it say they leaned into their sins? Well, it's a sordid picture that we get of the priests of the day. Okay, we'll take up there verse 9 next time. Thank you for listening.